Good afternoon. Welcome to We the People. This would be We the People really, 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 really running today. I know.
I'm here, though.
You made it just the last second.
I did.
Oh, my gosh. So, my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff with a big echo. What's going on there, Bob?
Bill.
Yeah.
I don't hear any echo. You sound fine to me.
Oh, uh-oh. It's just you.
It's an inner ear problem.
Yes. Huh. And, of course, Bob Martin is here.
Yes, I'm Bob Martin.
And that way we'll have really fun music and everything. And we're going to need fun music because it's not a particularly fun topic, although it is educational.
Good.
And this education is provided by...
Oh,
you like that segue?
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. Our sponsor this hour is Team Power, our local John Deere Kubota tractor dealer. And right now, you can give them a call at 226-9226. They're running their spring service special. So if you've got a tractor, a lawn tractor or small compact tractor, and you want to bring it in and get it serviced, they've got labor specials going on right now. Save you some money. 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake. Team Power, 226-9226. Give them a call.
They're going to call you, though, right?
Well, yeah, they could call me. They might be lucky enough to get me. You never know.
226, what is it? 9226?
9226.
Simple Simon.
Yeah.
All righty. So, let's see. You can find a ton of information at wethepeopleradio.us. That would be our website with archives going back to, 2010. And Robert Exter, big thanks to him. He always cuts out the celebrations of capitalism. And so you have commercial-free listening.
Commercial-free.
Free of charge. I guess a lot of websites charge for that.
Oh, really?
I was going to listen to somebody else's program the other day, and it's like, well, you have to subscribe for $10 a month or something like that. Bummer.
Yeah.
So anyway, archives are our archives, sure, easy for me to say,
easy for you.
Are always
are
free of charge.
Free.
But we would love your sponsorship, and there is a tab on the page if you would like to jump in and kick in whatever you'd like, because the show is paid for by... us and Team Power and a variety of listeners. So feel free to join in. Oh, good. We have him on. All right. So our guest today has been on with us before, but not since. I had to do a little homework on that last night. We haven't talked to William since April of last year. And we were just kind of doing a Canadian's view of what was going on in the U.S. because things must have been nutty last April, although they just released the big memo.
Oh, my gosh.
On FISA-gate or whatever we're calling it these days.
The memo.
The memo. Bill read it this morning. He was so freaked out.
Oh, my gosh. Unbelievable.
So, yeah. We'll have to... the whole world's doing programs
is
on the memo.
Is that all you got?
Huh?
Is that all you got?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, really.
Bring it on.
We're not going to deny
bring
it.
The
we're
memo.
Come out with our own memo.
That's right. It's not a lie. There's nothing wrong with it, but we're going to dispute it anyway because it makes us look bad.
Yeah. Oh, real bad.
Ding. So anyway, if you have
but all the while we're denying that it makes us look bad.
Yes, and we're denying that any of those things are true, although we can't factually refute any of them.
Looks bad to you.
Problem. So if you don't know what memo we're talking about, I don't know how that could happen, but this would be the 3-page and a paragraph memo that came from the from Devin Nunes, the House intelligence guy, who's been working on whether or not they started looking into this Russia thing, and suddenly, magically, it turned out that it was the DNC and the Clinton campaign that were actually spying on the Trump campaign. I mean, I think we learned at Watergate you couldn't do things like that, and this is obviously much larger than that. So I'll link the PDF to our page for today in case you haven't found it yet. It hasn't wormed its way into your consciousness.
In case you didn't get the memo.
In case you didn't get the memo. Nice, Bob. I was crying to be said. So anyway.
Someone had to.
Somebody has to say it. So you will have the memo if you didn't have the memo. And honestly, it's a fast read. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to sort it out. And once you start looking at who the players are and what they did, it's like, we've got a problem. Mm-hmm. So nice that it was made public. So, on that happy note, we're going to join our guest, William Kay. He is in Alberta, Canada, unless he moved since the last time we chatted with him.
I am still in Alberta. enjoying the wonderful weather.
Yeah, it's like 70-something here. I don't know what the heck's going on.
It's supposed to hit 80 degrees today, February.
Some sort of global warming flash going on here. But
We certainly don't have that here. It's 20 below Celsius, which is about 5 below Fahrenheit.
Oops.
And that's warm. It's been colder than that all week.
Oh.
And these are the daytime highs. These aren't the lows. These are the highs.
Oh, and we're wearing short sleeve shirts and sweating, so sorry about that. Actually, I'd like something in between. I'm a big fan of winter. I don't know. It'll come back, I'm sure. So you work on all sorts of stuff. Your website, first of all, and it's linked on our page, but is ecofascism.com. And so I don't know how we originally got connected with you. Just the fact that environmentalism is fascism was catchy and made me want to read more.
Yeah.
Made me want to chat with you back in 2011, I guess. And so it's led you recently into the topic of population control.
Yeah. Actually, the two social movements are almost inseparably conjoined. I've been meaning to do more writing about population control for over 20 years now, and I keep getting sidetracked into other issues. So I set aside a few months and read five more books on the topic and then sort of researched and fact-checked those books. But it was an interesting education for myself. It sort of brought myself up to speed. The initial posting that I just did ran as about 25,000 words. There's 17 articles there. And I didn't even get, I got as far as the 1990s. I thought if I have to go all the way to the modern day with this, it's going to be another 25,000 words. So I'm working on a part two, another posting, to deal with that. One of the humorous things about it is I really was motivated to get into it because there's so much, you know, gay agenda and transgenderism in the mass media and in popular culture right now. And I'm someone who's quite firmly of the opinion that that is a subsidiary movement or an auxiliary movement of the population control movement. And I really wanted to expose that. Never got around to it. Never made a keystroke on that topic. That'll have to wait. First, I wanted to establish that this movement is of a sufficient scale and awareness that it can actually pull off something that size. I wanted to establish that first, and that alone took months of reading and writing to get that far. But that's where I'm at right now. So I'm working on part two right now.
Well, you did a really, really good, I think it's like a 26-minute video, The History of the Population Control Movement, and we've posted that on our page. And I'm sure it's also linked on yours as well. But that was really an eye-opener for somebody who, you know, if
you thought it was like a modern day movement, I mean, this is
or you thought it was just BS.
Yeah.
You know, all population control, right? Like, who's going to do that?
It's been in full swing for a long time.
Yeah, I think this will smarten you up. And, you know, really, when you do talk to hardcore environmentalists, you know, the guys that just eat, sleep, and breathe this stuff, it always does go back to population. They're very open about it. There are just too many people. The people are, you know, causing the global warming. People are causing too much use of resources. And then you get into the who should be here and who shouldn't. I mean, it's a pretty quick trip.
There's a profound division within the environmental movement. If you would stop the calendar, say, around 1970, early 1970s, the entire environmental movement was universally supporting the population control movement. They were all believers in overpopulation. It was very much part of the same hysteria that went around in the early 1970s when that movement took on the name environmentalism. Over the next couple of decades, because issues like abortion and immigration are so dicey and so controversial, a large section of the environmental movement stopped talking about population. And so now you've got groups that still have population in their names. If you look at the environmental movement's propaganda, their websites, they all make some mention of it. If you look at the population control organizations, they all make a lot of mention about the environmental impact. But you know, the recent example, there's a group called Scientists and Environmentalists for Population Stabilization, classic population control activist group. They were denied a booth at a recent environmental conference. There were other environmental groups that did not even want them in the building.
Yeah,
so there is this division within the movement. They all tend to support it, but some of them have come to the view that this is bad PR. like the Sierra Club does not want to be associated with anti-immigration activism, abortion, things like that.
Right, and so the mention of population control is kind of taboo within their movement, within their public
but
image.
But they really do think that.
Yeah, but that is a big. Yeah, big part of it.
Universally.
So let's take a really quick break here, and when we come back, you can start us off wherever you'd like, because
I have a plan.
Okay, yeah. I'd really like people to hear your research, because it makes perfect sense. We will be right back. Our guest is William Kay. And now we're going to be talking about the history of population control. I think you'll like it, I guess I could say that. You can find everything at wethepeopleradio.us.
But good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
Too many people, and not enough eyes to see. Too many lives to lead, and not enough time. Lost the sun. She's come undone.
Too many people.
Too many people.
Yeah. They're eating all the food.
So, of course, we always have a group that's going to decide who the too many are.
Yeah, we're like
a Canadian group there, I'll have you know, the Guess Who.
Oh, it was? Oh, mm-hmm. Oh, see, it's good you're here to educate
Winnipeg,
us.
Winnipeg, Manitoba.
You go, baby.
Go, Winnipeg.
Okay.
All right. Fire the rocket.
Okay. Well, probably the most difficult concept when you talk about population control movement is the word movement. It's difficult to describe exactly what a social movement is. A lot of people have a tendency to describe movements as though they're conspiracies, but they're far larger things than that. They contain, like, a population control movement is a whole armada of politically motivated organizations. It involves thousands of organizations. It's not centrally coordinated. It's thoroughly integrated with the environmental movement, which is, of course, much larger. But there's a key concept in movement politics, and it's called the built constituency. And I will give an analogy, and hopefully I don't go too far out on the limb on this. The environmental movement was one of the driving forces behind global warming, that whole propaganda campaign, climate change. The environmental movement is large. There's probably around the world about 30 to 40,000 organizations that you would define as environmental movement organizations. What we now call the climate industrial complex, you know, all the manufacturers of wind turbines and solar panels and biofuels and that whole industry now, has an estimated annual turnover of about $1.5 trillion. Wow. $1.5 trillion. If you look at all of these environmental organizations, some of them appear very large, like, you know, World Wildlife Fund collectively probably have an annual budget of $500 million, Greenpeace in the hundreds of millions. A lot of these are large organizations. There's a lot of wealthy philanthropic organizations like the Rockefeller Foundation, Ford Foundation, the Pew Trusts. They pour scores of millions of dollars into these movements every year. But whereas it looks like the environmental movement is huge, the thing that they created, the climate industrial complex, is actually 100 times larger than what they have created. And without the changes to the environmental regulations, without the changes to, you know, the laws that made solar power economical, all the subsidies that went into creating wind power, without the changes of the regulatory environment, those industries would not exist. First came a political campaign. Then came an industry. You have the same phenomenon occurs within the population control movement. I prefer to call the population control movement the abortion, sterilization, contraception, medical industrial complex. It took decades, generations of political activism to change the laws regarding these issues, abortion, sterilization, etc. But now what you've got is an actual industry. There's an abortion industry there that did not exist before. It is now, in fact, larger than the political campaigners that created it. So it's like one gear is turning a much larger gear. There's like Planned Parenthood alone has 600 clinics. Like it's sort of a franchise operation. It has over 600 clinics. You know, they've got their receptionists and their janitors. It's a major organization. It has a budget of, you know, over $1 billion a year. That's much larger than, like, say, look at a group like Population Connection. A lot of the groups that are still advocating explicitly for population control. There's 30 or 40 major ones in the United States. The biggest by far would be the Population Council. It has a budget of about $85 million. But most of these other groups are actually quite small affairs, like $1 million, $2 million budget. The thing they created, like a lot of these big pharmaceutical companies that manufacture contraceptive pills, the amazing amount of sterilizations and things like that that go on, that's a multi-billion dollar industry. And those firms and businesses and medical practices that are involved in that, they have their own public relations departments and their own lobbying campaigns. So when we understand these sort of movements, you got to get this idea of like these small politically active gears eventually creating these large built constituencies that sort of feed back on them. These groups now, like a lot of wind power companies, give money to environmental organizations.
Sure.
Because without these regulations, they wouldn't exist. Yeah. So they sort of feed back on one another. What you've got in the United States and Canada, other countries, is this large abortion, contraception, sterilization industry that was created by the political activism of these population control groups.
Yeah.
How's that?
That's a mouthful. But it kind of demonstrates why in so many communities contraception is free. I mean, you can get free condoms, free IUDs, free birth control. You know,
well, and interesting. Every discussion about, you know, medical insurance that they somehow conveniently called health care.
Has to include.
Yeah. It has to include birth control, like somebody's paying a lot for it outside of their medical insurance.
I mean, you know, I encountered that so many times researching this. I'm starting to get deeply suspicious of the whole public health insurance industry. Mm-hmm. You know, the extent to which the population controllers were involved in this. Just keep in mind, let's take a step back a bit. You know, with the abortion campaigns, they really got going in the 1960s. At that time, the upper middle class, with their connections to society doctors, they already had access to safe abortions. The whole political campaign was to make sure that the poor, you know, the blacks, the what have yous, to make sure that they had access. This was an elite group trying to make sure that another group had access to abortion, sterilization, contraception. They were to foist it upon another group. And you look at these public health insurance debates and that, you know, and if you look at it from the angle of the population controllers, it's all about that. Mm-hmm. That's exactly the group they're talking about. They want to make sure they get free access to the pill and what have you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because
there was a time when USAID used to fly helicopters over the slums of Manila and throw condoms out the window.
Wow.
He's literally bombing the ghettos with condoms. The idea was just to inundate them, just to saturate these populations with contraception technologies.
Wow. Talk to us.
Go back to the beginning.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about the actual sterilization programs that have gone on in the past. And these aren't
right,
like,
but I mean,
small things.
He researched back to the 1800s.
Right.
And I think most people would say, oh, that's silly. It didn't. It that wasn't happening back then.
Oh, it existed in a clearly articulated form in the late 1700s, for sure. On the issue of sterilization, I date that to some speeches given by Francis Galton in the 1880s. And he was concerned that there were inferior strains of Englishmen, you know, Englishmen that weren't quite up to snuff. And he wanted to start to having mass sterilization programs to limit their breeding.
Mm.
Starting in about the 18, in the American context, from about 1897 to 1907, dozens of U.S. state legislatures passed compulsory sterilization laws. And it wasn't until Indiana in 1907, like until that time, either the governor would veto it or the courts would block it. And in 1907, Indiana passed a compulsory sterilization law. There was a very powerful political organization at the time called the Eugenics Research Office, and they created a model draft sterilization law that they, you know, sent to every legislator in the United States.
And how many
between 1907 and 19? Well, go ahead.
How many people? I mean, you know, I don't think people really have a firm grasp on how many people were affected by these sterilization laws around the world. I mean, they were
the world or in the United States?
Well, both, really. I mean, the United States, I think, came later, but
Indiana's law was the first in the world.
Oh, okay.
Oh, really?
In the United States, it was slightly less than 64,000 people suffered compulsory sterilization over the next 50 years. Now, these were people, like, taken in handcuffs to the surgery, okay? Mm-hmm. At that time, those started to become declared unconstitutional, that sort of practice. However, there was a U.S. federal court judge made a ruling and a finding of fact in 1974, and he estimated that there were up to about 100,000 Americans being sterilized every year upon threat that their welfare was going to be cut off, that their medical aid was going to be cut off. He estimated that the involuntary sterilizations. Now, these people were not being brought in handcuffs or shackles to the surgery room, but they were simply being pressured by doctors unlawfully. The people who were telling these people this information had no authority to cut them off welfare or to kick them off medical insurance programs, but they were successfully threatening them and browbeating them into going through a sterilization program.
So this is obviously
that the federal court considered.
This is obviously targeting the lower income folks. Right.
Always, and it's always racist. In every country, you see it. It's always racist. They're all weird definitions of racism because there's a lot of white versus white racism that used to be very clearly articulated within the eugenics movement, which you don't see too much of anymore. But in Nazi Germany, a 12-year period, 5% of the adult population, and these were Germans, were surgically sterilized.
Wow.
Because,
and quite often it was moral failings, you know. They had this whole thing with IQ tests, and the sterilization courts becoming agitated because so many of the people they declared to be feeble-minded were doing very well in these IQ tests. They sterilized them anyways because, you know, this guy was a ne'er-do-well. He was some troublemaker. He was a whatever, right? So just sterilize them. But that was, you know, a couple of million people in 12 years were sterilized. 5% of the adult population. And these were not the Jews. The Jews got exterminated. These were German citizens.
Wow.
You had even, in terms of like mass sterilization, I would point to 1976 India. They had what was called the Great Population Emergency, just a state of absolute hysteria that they were overpopulated. You know, India's population has grown by a third since then. There was no population crisis. There was no food crisis. But in a single year, 8.2 million people were forcibly sterilized in India. Over 2,000 people were shot dead resisting it. So those sorts of campaigns have been conducted in many countries. What you see now in the United States, there's still a mass sterilization program going on. They've just become a lot more sophisticated. Right now in the U.S., every year about 700,000 women are surgically sterilized. Dropping back a bit, the population control masterminds developed a program in Puerto Rico called the postpartum technique, and where they realized that it was very easy to capture women, to get them to agree to a sterilization operation if you talk to them either just before or just after childbirth. Because at that time, they more or less throw themselves at the mercy of the doctors, you know, whatever you say, doctor, and you can get them to consent to sterilization. They pioneered the program in Puerto Rico, a group called the Population Crisis Committee, which we could talk about later, and they handed the program over to the U.S. Department of Health, and within 10 years, they sterilized one-third of all the women in Puerto Rico, and it was almost entirely through that program. You'd go in to have a baby at a government clinic, and they would just put this, and then they really worked on the sales pitch of, you know, how you pitch it to a woman, you know, to get her to consent to this. Quite often they were on medication too, so it was, you know, voluntary in captions, you know. Right now in the U.S., there's about 700,000 women get sterilized every year. About 55% of them are within 48 hours of delivering birth. They're still using that postpartum technique. 10% of all births in the United States are immediately followed by a sterilization of the woman.
Wow.
A lot of the abortions, like there's a million abortions every year in the United States, they do the same thing. I couldn't get really hard stats on how many women have abortions, sterilizations following abortions. For at least a couple of decades, all the U.S. teaching hospitals, it was a requirement. If you wanted to have an abortion, you had to consent to a sterilization. But I was researching it, and there are so many of these abortion clinics, they advertise, yes, you come in, get your abortion sterilization combo package. I also came across a lot of the obstetrics journals and that, where they clearly promote it. One of the journals made it very clear that the doctor has a positive obligation to try to talk the woman coming in for an abortion to also have a sterilization.
Wow.
So 55% of those sterilizations are women who are immediately post-childbirth. I don't know what the percentage is for women who've just had an abortion. It's also considerably high. And there's some other stuff that goes on. The woman that does my proofreading for me on the website, she went in to have a cyst removed from her uterus when she was in her late 30s. The same thing happened. The doctor shows up at the foot of her bed, just before the surgery, and talked her into a hysterectomy. And I don't know how much of that's going on, but I think there's quite a bit of that going on.
Wow.
So revisiting that 700,000 women sterilized every year in the United States, I'm saying, 80% of them are women who have been sort of pressured or cajoled into a sterilization operation on the eve of some surgery or some major invasive medical process. It's a long ways from voluntary, and it's having a real impact. There's over 10 million women in the United States who have been surgically sterilized. You would find similar sort of ratios across the first world. But this program didn't stop. It became just more sophisticated. And you can bet, if you look at some of these groups like, the Center for Biological Diversity, and that, they've got over a million members. And that's an extreme population control group. And I wonder how many doctors are members of Population Connection. They claim to have 40,000 members.
That'd be crazy
negative
to know.
Population group.
Yeah.
What's that?
That would be pretty crazy to know. I mean,
I'm sure it's in the thousands upon thousands of doctors.
Right.
Absolutely.
And once again, they're highly selective. About who they're targeting for these sorts of things. You get a woman in her late 30s, part of the doctor just can say, well, you're not going to have kids anyways, why don't we just do this? And then he convinced her that it was probably better to, it was easier to do the operation if they did that. It sounded really sleazy, and you wonder if they, and a lot of countries like India and what have you, they had quota systems.
I wonder if it isn't going on today. We have to take a really quick break. When we come back, take us back to the beginning of this research of yours a little bit. Let's set the stage for how we got to where we are now, because I'm always worried that if we start with what's going on now, not having built the foundation,
yeah,
people will dismiss it, and your research is really good.
Somebody
we'll be right back.
Told me a long, long time ago.
Call her name at 7:30. I pace around the parking lot, and I walk down thousand gifts that I got. Can't you see? It's not me you're dying for, and she's feeling more alone than she ever had.
Yeah, there's no point in being here. It's not that great.
Consider okay. The alternative.
Yeah, that's how they do it. They do it with music.
Yeah. Everybody's doing it.
Oh, my God.
Well, they do.
So, okay, back in the day, because your first...
Okay.
Well, your very first title in your table of contents...
Malthus.
Malthus.
Yeah.
And so who exactly is that? And what did they do?
Malthus,
big deep.
He trained to be an Anglican church minister, but he made his career as England's first, probably the world's first professor of political economy. His dates are 1766 to 1834. And his launch into fame was a essay, small book that he wrote 1798 called The Principle of Population. And as I point out on the posting, he was a very two-faced sort of guy. You really have to read more of his stuff to see it. On one hand, he's sort of addressing the general reading public, and he's saying, you know, the world's overpopulated. Agriculture will never keep up with the rate which human people are breeding. And with another voice, he's quite clearly talking to the rural elites of England, and he's talking about the laboring classes. You know, they're hired hands, they're sharecroppers, they're sort of, you know, the toiling herd. They are breeding too fast. In 1795, a few years before he wrote his first essay, one of the counties in England, the Berkshire County, passed the Berkshire, it was called the Outdoor Relief Act, something like that. It was basically a welfare policy. They were going to use parish funds, and they were going to subsidize the incomes of the working poor. And a lot of the rural elites, some of the rural elites benefited from this because they had a lot of seasonal laborers, and this was a way to keep those people alive when you didn't really need them on the farm. But generally, across the gentry, and Malthus was born unto the gentry, and these are people who have scores of sort of hired hands and tenant farmers and sharecroppers and what have you, they dreaded this idea of giving them welfare because they thought it would undermine labor discipline and they would just start breeding like rabbits. And that was the big fear then, and it remains that fear. It's sort of, it's the lower working class, it's the working class in general. It isn't so much that the world can't support more and more people. If they thought that the economic system or the property system that they had in place in England could not deal with these rapid population increases. So it would better just to, rather than modify England's property regime, which would require throwing into cultivation a lot of uncultivated land. And he was very clear about that. They didn't want that happening. And he said, if you kept doing that, the gentry would end up just being farmers like everybody else. All the hired hands would run off and get their own farms. And that certainly wasn't, he was very clear that, you know, what you really need is a rural elite that has enough time and leisure to become scholars and artists and then philosophers like him. And throwing open the wilderness to your hired hands isn't going to do it because right. They're going to leave. They're going to go to America.
So
that was not an option. The main option, as he thought, was, you know, finding ways to suppress the fertility rate. And he was absolutely brutal about talking about ways to increase the mortality rate. He was explicitly calling for, you know, situating the lower class areas of the city near marshes and swamps, undermining public health, thwarting popular sanitation programs. They wanted these people to die young. And he was very, very explicit about that, as were his followers. Like the real drive behind the anti-vaccination movements came out of the Malthusian community. Even as late as, you know, John D. Rockefeller III, he created the Population Council in 1952 after he had a bitter break with the Rockefeller Foundation because they, it was sort of a self-perpetuating board of trustees, and he was telling them, you know, your programs of public health and your programs of the, of promoting new agricultural technology are just leading to this population explosion. They're
right.
just sort of causing more problems down the road.
So you control.
So that's been a consistent theme of this movement, you know, from the 1790s up to the present.
So how does that, you know, how does that work with what we're, you know, basically what he was saying was you control the numbers of cheap labor to control the expansion, and we're kind of doing the opposite now, aren't we?
You've got a very conflicted system. And you've got these immigrants coming in while you're suppressing your birth population. What's bizarre is in America, you know, the abortions almost equal the number of immigrants.
Right.
I mean, if it was just a matter of bodies, you could just stop one and the other. You stop them both. The only explanation for that is that you've got, you know, conflicts within the political elites, conflicts within the ruling elites. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a lot of the major employers are pretty much for wide-open immigration. They want the cheap labor coming in. This wasn't always the case. I mean, that was... These tensions really blew up in the 1920s in America when they first passed the Immigration Control Act in 1924. And then there was really this sharp division. Like the railroaders, they wanted as much immigrants as possible. They had built these railway lines on the understanding that they were going to put farmers on either side of them all the way to the Pacific Ocean. But there was always an element, particularly within the U.S. Northeast, of the rentier scholars. These were people who had inherited, you know, significant fortunes, and they had a different mindset. So what you're seeing in America doesn't make any sense. What you're seeing in a lot of these countries, like Canada, doesn't make any sense. On the one hand, you've got this really intense fertility suppression campaign going on that's very successful. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you're welcoming in all these immigrants. That is just because you've got conflicting elites. That's the only explanation I can come up with. And it's pretty verifiable. But you're right, it's a huge contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because they always talk about the immigrant population. Well, who's going to pick the lettuce? Who's going to work in your motels? And it's like, wow. So you really are importing. I mean, there is an effort to import a lower class of
cheap laborers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt about that. But that tension is not new. I mean, in the debate that roiled around the 1924 Immigration Act, the American sort of, the elite community was very bitterly divided. There was always an element from the Chamber of Commerce, certainly from the railroaders, a lot of the merchants, what have you. They wanted a lot more immigrants, as does the U.S. Chamber of Commerce today. They're pretty much open borders. And it's interesting because the Democratic Party of the United States is the one that is so pro-abortion, so pro-transgenderism, and so pro-mass contraception and what have you. They're all so open borders. It's just a deep conflict and a deep contradiction within the system. What you will find in the, you know, the official population control movement, you will find a lot of anti-immigrant activism there. And a lot of that, they've attracted a lot of attention of the old-school racist community. And that's what's really, that's why the mainstream environmental movement doesn't want to have anything to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, definitely there's probably a couple of dozen groups that have the word population in their name in the United States that are explicitly, adamantly opposed to any kind of immigration.
Right.
But they obviously do not have the ear of government.
Well,
at this point.
And I think the thing we're seeing really clearly from our, you know, not everyone in the Democratic Party, because obviously everyone doesn't get to speak at once, but the leadership anyway, is that they are much more concerned about what happens with a handful, really, in the scope of all things, a handful of illegal aliens versus their own citizens that they are supposed to be representing.
Those are undocumented Americans, by the
undocumented
way.
The undocumented Americans seem to be taking precedence over the documented Americans. We've got to take one more quick break, and we're going to come back with our guest, William Kay, in case I forgot to say that last time. And he will be with us through the next hour, too, because there's no possible way we're going to get through all of this information. It's really fascinating, and it's something that I think people should be aware of, or they will not see it. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
You heard it.
There you go.
You heard it here first.
Population boom.
Yeah. Subliminal 70s.
Well, and he talks about that in his articles, the subliminal 70s. Who is that?
The Stylistics.
Oh, how did I not know that?
Can I put in a request for the DJ? Diana Ross and the Supremes, Love Child.
Oh, very good.
My favorite, Population Control. We'll play that at the next break.
Ah, nice. Okay, so...
Anyways.
All right, so these guys, at the early end of this, right, they were looking at the underclass. These were the people who worked in the factories, and before factories, they worked on the farms. And so they basically were doing all the labor. These were the laborers, and they felt that they were inferior.
Well, when Malthus, he was very clear that he said when he referred to the laboring classes of society, he was referring to the majority of the society, the majority of English population.
But he didn't actually
feel... It wouldn't have just been the lowest of the low. This would have been the broader sort of working mainstream population.
And he didn't actually believe there was a population problem, though.
I probably uncovered a dozen quotes where he talks about the scanty population of the earth. He talks about knowing of countries where you could increase the population by 100-fold.
Okay, so he didn't really think there was a problem, but he pitched it as a way to control.
He was just very two-faced. I mean, he would always put out this the great law that he had uncovered, which was that human population exceeds agricultural output, which was nonsense. Okay, agricultural output is constantly growing faster than the human population. And this was occurring while he was writing this. Europe was undergoing a major agricultural revolution.
Wow.
But he was oblivious to that, and that's just been drilled into people's heads. I mean, I did not, expend a single word debunking the overpopulation myth. To me, it is so obviously false, it is not even worth addressing. And the more you read about the movement, you realize they don't believe in it either. They've got other agendas. I really like that group. I don't like them, but they're so betraying of their own motives. The Center for Biological Diversity, which is a newer group in the United States, which now has over 1 million paying members. But they keep driving home this point that like what they're really into is saving the wildlife, saving the wilderness, what have you. They hand out condoms with polar bears on them, stuff like that. But I Googled population control in their own search database, 524 articles. Wow. And they are militant population hawks.
Mm-hmm.
But they're hitting the nail on the head. If there's a, it's the grow and explode thing. If the population were to, their fear is, the population were to grow to a certain point, a lot of people in the cities are going to start looking at these wilderness areas.
Right.
And saying, why don't we open these up for development? And that, of course, is the great horror, the great dread. You know, you live in a country that's, you know, 50-60% public lands taken out of development, a huge room to expand and open into new frontiers. And I live in a country that's, you know, that times 10.
And
yet there's a perception that there's a shortage of land and
right.
there's too many people. And it's
right.
an utter absurdity.
And they're going to use a little bit of it.
Their fear is someday the American population are really going to have a free and open discussion
right.
about what should we be doing with public land.
Yeah.
And you haven't heard that in your lifetime. I haven't heard it in Canada either. But at some point, that's going to be the main issue of an election. It's not going to be gay marriage. It's going to be, what should we do with these public lands?
Right.
Yeah, and we're not allowed to, you know, drill on them or use them, and the environmentalists all freak out. We're destroying our public land, and
you know, look at the, you know, the forestry industry in California. Look at the coast, the northern coast of California. Its potential to grow.
Yep.
If they would just throw it open for development, it'd be a tremendous boom.
Yeah, we're sitting in a resource-rich environment, obviously, and they won't let go of it. So
talk about the dams.
Yeah. Don't get me started. when we come back, though, we've got to make sure and hit Margaret Sanger and that whole thing, because that's really important for people to know if they don't already. We'll be back with our guest, William Kay. We're talking about population control on Sunday afternoon here at We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
You're joining us on KCNR, Shasta Redding.
Hello. Welcome to the second hour of We the People. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And this hour is brought to you by
Team Power.
What is Team Power, Bill?
Team Power is our local John Deere and Kubota tractor dealer. And boy, if you want a tractor, that's the place to go in Redding.
Yeah,
I'll tell you what.
Because the crowds go wild.
Yeah, they do. They do go wild. And right now they're running their spring special.
Yeah, wait. Winter ended last week when it became 75 degrees.
Yeah, it's February and we don't have a winter anymore. But they are running their spring special on repairs. So if you have a mower, and mower season's going to be on us before you know it with this kind of weather, get in there and get that thing tuned up and get your blade sharpened, and they've got a special going that they'll take care of you. Also, too, if you have a small tractor you need fixed up, we can work on that as well. Team Powers at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake, right off I-5. And their phone number is 226-9226. Give them a call.
Ta-da! Look at that.
There you go.
All right. And we've got archives stretching back to 2011. You can find it all at wethepeopleradio.us. And all our information about our guest is on there. And the archive of today's program will be on there as well. And I got to tell you, you probably are going to want to go back. And one thing you're definitely going to want to do is listen to William's 7-minute video that's on the page about this, and I would send that to somebody, especially somebody that you know that might have been kind of drawn into the whole environmental thing from the standpoint of there are just too many people, that's what's ruining the environment and the earth, blah, 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 and we don't have enough food, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I hear this from people fairly regularly. It might just be my line of work, but that's not an unusual thing for folks that are in that that universe to traffic in. The Center for Biological Perversity, actually I think it's supposed to be diversity, but they're not diverse. They're, for those of you who live in Northern California and who followed or who live elsewhere and have followed our shows, they were the biggest promoters of the reintroduction of wolves. So You start looking, they're super involved in population control. Let's see, they want wolves everywhere. Huh.
Yeah, it'll keep them out of the woods.
I mean, kind of starts to add up a little bit, a little too handily. So,
there are a lot of environmental groups promoting sharks, like Defend the Shark.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
Talk about ruining a beach, you know.
Keeps me out of the water, trust me.
I'll tell you what, we think back on times like, you know, we were
in Hawaii. Improve my swimming, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not doing that anymore. So, okay, so tie this in with Margaret Sanger and that whole industry of birth control, because I think people, how do I want to say that? I think we've been led to believe, how's that, that the birth control thing was for our benefit, that for our, like, society's benefit, that's something responsible people do, and that abortion is a right, and that it's not killing, and you're not killing people, and all these things just must be done in a civilized society.
I can describe three different occasions in this movement. And keep in mind, this is a 230-year-old movement, probably older than that if you wanted to count some of the, you know, genocidal campaigns in the past. But in the modern English-speaking world, there's been two or three times when the movement has recruited some women to serve as the public face of the movement. And, you know, there was quite an active movement to legalize and popularize contraception in the 1870s, and they had Annie Besant ran that. And these people were all raving Malthusians, believed the world was overpopulated, they believed all the famines in Asia were caused by overpopulation, and they were promoting contraceptions. But after World War I-ish in the United States, the movement, which was primarily then calling itself the eugenics movement, they recruited women like Margaret Sanger, another woman from Norway called Elise Ottensen Jensen. And these women had the same sort of biographies. Their mothers had had umpteen kids and had died young from having too many kids. And they were fronting a bunch of birth control clinics that were popping up in Northern Europe and along the U.S. Northeast, as a better public face for the movement than the regular old crowd, which tended to be very sort of wealthy, older, white men. This was more of a public relations thing. You know, these old inheriting dynasties, they weren't recruited and mesmerized by Margaret Sanger. No, they employed her to be their public spokesperson. She herself told the party line, by all accounts, fully believed in it. At the time, the movement was explicitly racist, explicitly classist. She gave many speeches to the Ku Klux Klan. She called the primary motivation of birth control should be eliminating the dead weight of human waste by cleansing the gutters. These are her lines, right? And you can also get them from Mary Stopes and other ones. Sanger would go on at great length about the millions of dollars we're spending on people who should never have been brought into this world. She was an outspoken supporter of racial improvement through sterilization. She was an outspoken anti-immigrant activist. This was, you know, I was impressed. I went to the Planned Parenthood Federation. They even have a little essay for us trying to debunk that. Great strategy. What they did was come up with three or four times where she's been misquoted, and they show that these were misquotes. You know, I could find you hundreds of quotes that definitely link her unequivocally to, you know, extreme population control, extreme racist ideologies, you know, an extreme attack on the rights of the poor to have kids, things like that. There's no questioning that, whatever. Moreover, like, she was the front person for the American Birth Control League, 1921. The entire board of directors, they were notorious racists even for their day. One of the leading figures, Lothrop Stoddard, from somewhere in the U.S. Northeast. This was someone who later became a very outspoken supporter of the Holocaust, you know, openly calling for the extermination of the Jews, who traveled to Nazi Germany so that he could be a guest sitter on the eugenics court, where they declared, you know, various people proper to be sterilized, and wrote a book about that, saying what a wonderful program the Nazi sterilization program was. I couldn't count the number of people I came across during the course of this, in and around Sanger and all the other people who were outspoken supporters of Adolf Hitler. I'll give you one of my faves. The next time you're on Google, Google the phrase engender health. And it will take you to a nonprofit organization which has a budget of around $60 million. A lot of that coming from the U.S. government. And they're in the business of promoting reproductive rights and sexual freedom in the third world primarily, where $60 million moves a lot of people. And they have this little sort of video that comes on. It's all about, you know, these really happy women of color and how they're now living much better lives because of the work of Engender Health. Read closer. All they're doing is sterilizing people. Engender Health started out in the 1930s as an organization called the New Jersey Sterilization League. Their founder, another female who had inherited quite a bit of money, traveled to Nazi Germany so that she could write the English subtitles or captions for Hitler's speeches and propaganda films. It was a group that was, you know, very explicitly racist, very explicitly supportive of basically a genocide against the American blacks. That group has gone through several name changes. It is now called Engender Health, and they're out there in the third world helping these women of color, you know, with their reproductive freedom.
What does Engender Health? You said that's primarily funded by U.S. dollars.
Yeah, U.S. government.
U.S. government,
yep.
And does that come from like the health department? Where does that money come from? I mean,
that would come from USAID's Office of Population.
Hmm.
Now they're not allowed to specifically pay for abortions, but they can seemingly pay for everything but an abortion, and then somehow facilitate it that way. And they can, you know, it's really dicey. It's all these organizations, you know, that they're really not supposed to be paying for any sort of coerced abortions, but you know that their definition of voluntary is not the same as everyone else's.
Right.
But I encourage you to check out their website and then Google the phrase the New Jersey Sterilization League. This is the same organization. But certainly, yeah, USAID is one of the main bankrolls of it. It's different now. Trump's in power. There's always been this huge controversy regarding the UN Fund for Population Activities,
mm-hmm.
which has got $1 billion a year budget. They were definitely implicated in some coercive sterilization and coercive abortions in China, and that has led to, certainly under Reagan, the U.S. government cut off their funding, and then Clinton restored it, Bush cut it off, Obama restored it. But the U.S. government, certainly from, you know, basically the year 1965 to 1985, was indubitably the world's largest promoter and financier of some of the most coercive population control programs we've ever seen. And that went on under Clinton. Again, there were some particularly nasty forced sterilization campaigns in Peru and places like that, paid entirely by U.S. taxpayers' dollars.
Wow.
it's one thing that all these things are going on, but it's another thing that people are paying for it and they don't even know.
It's another form of coercion. It's another way that this movement builds itself so much these days that it's all voluntary. This is all voluntary sterilization and voluntary abortions. No one's being coerced into doing anything.
It's a right.
But if a taxpayer doesn't want to pay for this,
right?
That's a form of coercion right there. And if you're dealing with, you know, really poor people who are going to the doctor for help, and the doctor's got this set sales pitch, oh, you should have an abortion and you should have sterilization. It also undermines the sort of the meaning of voluntary as well. They're past the really bad old days. The last time I really know of a really nasty coercive sterilization program was against there's a province of Peru that was mostly Inca Indians, and over 300,000 sterilizations. And as there was a government study in Peru after they changed governments there. Over 90% of those women were told it was a reversible procedure.
Ouch.
Ooh.
This was a temporary sterilization.
See,
in
the last time this crossed our path was with Patrick Wood, and we were talking about technocracy, and back in the 20s, they had convinced people, he was adopted by a woman who had been sterilized by her mom, took her in and had her sterilized. She was part of the technocracy movement back then. And they were all told that if you have anybody who's a defective, basically, in your gene pool, you would be, you know, you'd be making the world better by not bringing, by not carrying that gene out. And so that,
yeah,
I mean,
that's classic eugenics. That is
sure,
classic
that,
eugenics.
Sure, that's
right,
that's 100 years ago or less.
Also, keep in mind, eugenics was like thoroughly debunked. Eugenics is to genetics what, you know, astrology is to astronomy.
I see what you mean. Like,
these people thought that there was a gene for laziness.
Right, right.
These people thought, you know, they had a, you know, there was a single gene for, you know, things like, you know, propensity to steal or something like that.
Right.
They thought there was a gene for
poverty,
liberalism,
being accident prone. That's why they didn't want to pay for workers' compensation and all that sort of stuff. Well, the guy's genetically, you know, clumsy. You know, it's better off that he gets killed on the work site. We could end that whole gene pool right there. Well, these guys were absolutely.
This is like the Darwin Awards on drugs. We have to take a really quick break. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Obviously, we're going to run out of time, and we're going to have to hold you hostage. Thank God you're trapped in the snow up there in Canada. This is working out to our advantage. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. That's your theme song there, William.
There you go.
When in your next video, you just need this playing in the background.
Copyright.
Bob.
Hey, William.
Mel Brooks, the producer, of course.
Of course.
Yes, of course. And
hey,
it's a joke.
You had mentioned China, and I had read something quite some time ago about China's population program has now kind of put them at a disadvantage for labor because there's so few babies being born. There's almost like a generation missing to kind of refuel their production. They don't have enough people to work in the factories now. Have you read about that? I'm sure you have.
There's probably about 20 countries that fit that description. Europe more than any of them. South Korea's got that problem. Japan has got that problem. These have all had these fertility suppression programs in spades. And, they've, you know, it's, I don't know, so there's also a question of how quickly your economy's growing and how quickly mm-hmm. you're automating labor, things like that. I suspect that, you know, that there was, the Chinese program's a bit overblown. I really, as I write in the posting, I think to some extent they have conned the Western world. I don't think their program was as severe as we might have been led to believe. I believe there was a very severe period in it. Yeah, 1981, 1982, where it was probably the most extreme population control program ever. But it really only lasted for a year or two.
Okay.
One thing, keep in mind this, is that, it's sort of complicated, but the sort of Chinese Communist Party had this thing about the four modernizations. They really had to improve their technology, and they had to improve their military and all this sort of stuff. And they really needed access to Western technology and Western markets to achieve that. And at that time, the U.S. government, this is the 1970s, was completely in the throes of population hysteria. And that sort of the trade-off was that they were going to have to, China was going to have to get really serious about population control if they wanted to be recognized by the USA, if they wanted the Western countries to open up their markets to them, if they wanted the World Bank to lend them money. So the UNFP, the United Nations Fund for Population Activity, the World Bank, these groups went into China. They strongly pressured the Chinese government to ratifying the one-child policy, which they did. Mm-hmm. And then there was a period basically, 81, 82 in there, where, like, I'm not exaggerating, probably 20 million people were sterilized under rather coercive conditions. There was all sorts of reports about pregnant women being dragged into the clinics and what have you. That got shut down within a few years. China's popularity there, the one-child policy was in effect from 1980 to 2015. China's population increased from 1 billion to 1.4 billion. That would have been impossible had there actually been a one-child policy. For a population to remain stable, the fertility rate has to be 2.1 kids per female. The 0.1 is because there's somebody die young or they don't have kids or what have you, that you actually need more than two per couple to sustain a population. So for them to increase their population by 40% in 35 years, they would have basically had to have an average fertility rate of over three. So I really question how extreme that was. In all likelihood, and this is something that happens all around the world, these population control programs are internally very racist. The dominant ethnic group, the Hans in China, were being very coercive towards Tibetans, towards their Uyghur or the Muslim populations. You might have found a lot of coercion there, but it seems to me the numbers don't add up, and there could not have been a really imposed one-child policy. They seem to have a fairly, there's a lot of abortions and sterilizations going on there, but I suspect there has been some exaggeration of it. And there were teams from Britain and America that went to study. They're dubious as well because they were very connected to the whole population control thing, but dubious. But on the issue of, who gets, their population, their fertility limited, you see some really nasty examples of that in Africa, sort of whatever sort of ruling ethnic tribe is in control of the state. They're all for population control, but they usually have some other minority groups within the state who they are going to target for these, you know, really extensive coercion, abortion, sterilization, contraception programs. In all likelihood, it was probably what caused a lot of the ethnic wars that you saw in Rwanda and Burundi, because the initial ruling groups were so aggravating some of the ethnic minorities with these intensively promoted fertility limitation campaigns that it rises up into an all-out race war. That has happened on more than one occasion in Africa.
Is the U.S. funding that goes to these programs, is it direct funding, or is most of it going through the U.N.? Do you know?
Be both. We're dealing with probably a couple of billion dollars. These are the ones that are going outside of the country. I don't have the numbers on top of my head, but I would say probably about, half or so, or hundreds of millions of dollars are going through various UN organizations. It's difficult, just this morning I was trying to read the UNFP's website and try to figure out exactly where the money's coming from, where the money's going.
There's
a serious lack of transparency there.
Yeah.
And actually there's a book out now about the hundreds of millions of dollars that go missing completely from some of these, specifically the UNFPA thing. But the USAID remains a major funder. I'm just ballparking it probably at around $500 million a year. Although Canada, because Trump is cutting back, Justin Trudeau is stepping up, and he's just announced that the Canadian government is going to be spending over $500 million for the next 3 years. So $170 million a year U.S. to sort of pick up where the Americans are dropping the ball, and that money will definitely go for abortion.
Well, that's fantastic. And you guys just did a little gender bendering on your national anthem too, right? Aren't you?
Oh yeah, it's not that I know the lyrics. We're Canadians; no one knows the lyrics here. Well, the national anthem count is a joke. It was originally written as a French-Canadian separatist anthem.
Oh.
They sing different lyrics in Quebec.
It isn't like ours where you boycott the Super Bowl because they knelt during...
No, we just don't know the lyrics out here. In my own lifetime, they've changed them a dozen times.
God, if they tried to change the lyrics,
the song
here,
behind it is Mozart's "The March of the Priests," which is oh so telling.
Yeah, it does mean something. Well, I looked up. Shoot, gotta take another darn break. Hooray for capitalism, though. But I'm looking on this Engender Health. So their website is engenderhealth.org, and I did post that on our page. But I was kind of taken in here. You had Africa, you had Asia.
Aren't they a very friendly, progressive bunch of people?
Aren't they? Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, Africa, okay, yeah, I see that coming. Asia, yep, see that coming. The Americas, Americas. And in America, the only place that they are targeting, only place, for the $64,000 question, Bill Cundiff, can you tell us where in the United States they are focusing their efforts?
Detroit.
Texas. I was like, are you kidding me? That's not actually what I was saying. I was saying other things that are not radio friendly.
Wow.
Texas? What the heck? Hmm. Yeah. So anyway, if you didn't want to go read about that, I think you should, people who are listening.
I'm looking at the page right now.
Yes, people who are listening, I think this is highly interesting. We're going to give you 2 minutes to research that, and when we come back, I want your take on why they're picking Texas, because I already have my own ideas, and of course, people are always free to come up with their own ideas. We don't want to tell you how to think. We just want to point you to the information. So we're here with our guest, William Kay. His website is ecofascism.com. Just so easy for me to remember and catchy, super catchy. And you can find all the information about him and all the rest of the stuff we've been talking about at wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back. Queued up before we talked about Texas.
Yeah, well.
Well, that was just some classic country Loretta Lynn.
You've got game, Bob. Okay, so what's the deal? Why do they want to cut with the population in Texas?
Because there apparently, according to them, there is too many teenage girls in Texas becoming pregnant. Hmm. And it's because they don't have Engender Health going there and educating young people about how traditional gender norms increase the risk of pregnancy.
Yeah, I like that part.
If they were only lesbians,
exactly, then it would be it'd be okay.
Yeah, could it have something to do with the fact Texas has been very active in shutting down a lot of Planned Parenthood offices in that state?
That would be they're partnering with Planned Parenthood of Greater Texas to do that. I'm not sure why Engender Health would in particular target Texas. What I've noticed about the environmental movement is they've, you know, divided up the entire world. Every square foot has been sort of parceled out. So it looks like, you know, tens of thousands of little organizations just fighting to save this little creek or fighting to save this little park. There are other, it's far more centralized than it appears. And they really, every square inch of North America has a designated group defending it. I suspect that within the population control movement, somehow Engender Health got the Texas file. And there are other groups within this movement that would be targeting, you know, Mississippi or what have you. The entire country, as is Canada, is blanketed and saturated with anti-natalist propaganda and activism. I don't think, I would be surprised if Texas was really being singled out by the movement rather than Engender Health. Picking, you know, from their own stats, they're saying that there's an unusual amount of teenage pregnancies there.
Well, and for crying out loud, most of those are going to be conservative.
The fact that there's an unusual amount of people
exactly.
There has something
good
to do with
that. That is a good point. I mean,
that was the first thing I thought of was
politically incorrect babies.
Yeah,
that's right.
They're traditionally
even worse.
They're gun advocates. They're states' rights advocates. These guys are hardcore. You know, Americans.
Don't
for the
mess
most
with
part.
Texas.
Exactly. I mean, they've got a long history there,
mm-hmm.
And it's interesting.
I hear what you're saying, but look, this movement is much stronger in Sweden and in other places like that, where they really drive it to the kids. So I don't think that Texas is being.
It just seems weird.
Out. This group is.
Yeah, it just seems
it
weird with
weird
this group and the whole country that
of
that's
all the places in Canada, in the states, they pick Texas. But
yeah, no kidding. Like that's our crisis point. Like you know, all the little kids being born to gang members in, you know, Chicago and Detroit and L.A. That's not a problem, I guess. Anyway,
this movement. I didn't go into this, you know, thinking that there was that much. My research has led me to believe there's actually more anti-black racism at higher levels in the United States than I thought before. This movement has historically targeted blacks for abortions, for sterilizations, without a doubt. And they were very explicit in the earlier stages of the movement. This is what it was about. It was about suppressing the blacks' birth rate. Since Roe v. Wade, there's been almost 20 million black abortions. It is not as though, it's same with, you know, Black Lives Matter. They talk about police brutality. The reality is, you know, whites are also victims of that. There is a slight disproportion of police brutality against blacks, even more so in things like abortion, these abortion clinics. They really do target black neighborhoods, and they really targeted black Africa. There are definitely people in the higher echelons of the population control movement that have a thing for blacks. They really are going out of their way to target them, not to an extreme degree. I mean, black abortions are about a third of all the abortions in the United States, whereas blacks are about 13 or 14% of the American population. So it's a noticeable bump. You might be able to explain that entirely through poverty. You know, that the blacks are poorer than the rest of the population, and then this is leading them to want more abortions. But it's clear from the history of this movement that they have long and explicitly, certainly Margaret Sanger and her friends, one of the women that she worked with was an outspoken black racist, anti-black racist, who invented various contraceptions and, you know, used black women for human experiments and things like that. There's some real nastiness in there. And, yeah, I can't deny it that there is, this movement, the population control movement, has a noticeable, although not overwhelming, hostility towards blacks. And I didn't go into that thinking that this would be the case. And so much of mass media seems to be hyping and promoting blacks far more than the talent of the entertainer would warrant. It's pretty clear that on the ground, they're targeting them. The key concept is crypto-eugenics. You know, the whole movement had a sea change of opinion after World War II, and there was a general understanding that they would no longer be explicitly racist. They wouldn't even use the word eugenics anymore. They were basically carrying on the same program as before with some modifications. But before 1940s, the movement was openly racist. And after that, they learned to put a lid on that, and the brain, the masterminds of that was the head of the British Eugenics Society, C.P. Blacker, and the Frederick Osborne of a really very powerful Osborne family of New York City. And they just said, it's just really counterproductive to really be insulting the people you're trying to suppress the fertility of. You know, if the Ku Klux Klan marched into Detroit and set up a Planned Parenthood clinic, cut the ribbon, no one would go there.
Right.
There was a time in the early 70s when the Black Panthers used to attack birth control clinics. Nation of Islam, a lot of these militant black groups used to physically attack birth control clinics because they viewed them as attempted genocide.
Right.
Which
one of the real... to some extent, those, if you read from their point of view, they tend to exaggerate. It's like Black Lives Matter. They are exaggerating the degree to which they are being centered out by the police department.
Right, right.
If you read the black militants, yeah, they exaggerate too. They describe the whole population control movement or the abortion movement as entirely devoted to suppressing blacks. No, most abortions in America are not performed on black women. But there is this bump in the statistics, undeniably, that it's there.
I've always heard that the bulk of the abortion clinics are in black neighborhoods. Is that actually?
I haven't seen sort of have it mapped out. There's a video they put out a long time ago called "American Abortion: Hitler Would Have Loved It." They do target poor neighborhoods. They target those areas. That was always the thrust. The upper middle class people, they have these posh hospitals they can go to. The whole point of the political movement was to get abortions to people that would not have otherwise had them, that would not have otherwise been able to pay for them, and it definitely worked.
So you put them in neighborhoods.
2,000 abortion clinics in America.
Right, right.
Jeez.
I heard a while back too that Bill Gates was a big advocate of population control. Have you heard that? Is that true?
Oh yeah, there's a number of videos of him online pontificating about that quite explicitly. There's one video online. He's talking about climate change. He's got this little algebraic formula, number of emissions times number of people. And in that video, he quite clearly says that he wants to see human population growth brought to zero, which is refreshing. Having gone through so many of these documents and videos, most of the people in that movement are calling for population reduction. Like Ted Turner is calling for an 80% reduction in the Earth population. There's a group, Negative Population Growth. They want like 100 million people in America. Like so many of these groups, it's almost refreshing when they're only talking about population stabilization. You got to wonder, what sort of policies would you have in effect to have the population to be, radically declining
reduced
over the course of a generation?
80%?
Yeah, there's only one method of doing
that. Ask Ted if he wants to take one for the team.
War, famine. I think Malthus has listed them all, war, famine, plagues, what have you. There's ways to do it. Some of the stuff I read about, in Stephen Mosher's book about AIDS in Africa, I don't want to go too far down the conspiratorial road, but just as it relates to population control, all around the world, different countries have different favorite methods of population control. And in Africa, at the behest of these elite population groups like the World Bank and USAID and UNFPA, the most popular form of population control was those injectables like Depo-Provera, things like that. In order to implement that program, it meant over the course of between 1990 and near 2000, they distributed over 100 million reusable injectable needles into poor neighborhoods of Africa.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of people believe that did more to promote AIDS and HIV than anything else. They also insisted, the population control masterminds, that HIV/AIDS be merged with their birth control program, so there'd be a single clinic catering to both. There was a very good study that showed that the number one correlation between getting AIDS in Africa as opposed to anywhere else was whether or not you had attended these clinics, these birth control clinics. In Africa, AIDS is almost exclusively or overwhelmingly something that inflicts women. of childbearing age, whereas everywhere else in the world, it's the injection drug addicts, it's the homosexuals, groups like that are the primary carriers of the virus.
Yeah, so how do you
explain
that?
Completely different picture in Africa.
Yeah, so how do you explain that? I mean, that's pretty much the clinics.
Well, I can tell you that the politicians in Africa, there's hundreds of them, openly call it genocide. There was an actual strategy to infect the African population with that virus. I don't know. I mean, for that sort of an allegation, I'd want a little more evidence. But, yeah, it seems to me it's beyond comprehension or beyond believability that these epidemiologists who were setting up these programs would not be aware that the way they designed these programs, that mass distribution of needles, the fusing of the HIV/AIDS with the birth control programs would not lead to a spread.
Oh,
and a
sure.
lot of the sort of sterilizations and what have you there are done in like horribly unsanitary conditions.
Right. Well, just the reusing of needles is just
asking for a health
problem.
They do. They reuse the needles. That
is
standard practice there. They reuse them hundreds of times.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God.
And then they throw them in the garbage and the rag pickers get them and they still circulate in the economy.
Right, right. Because they're still good.
No, so that Stephen Mosher's book, he's adamantly of the opinion that that it was the population controls policies in Africa led to the explosion of AIDS in Africa. He directly links that.
Wow.
And put a lot of zeros behind the number of dead people, for sure.
Jeez. And you've only researched this up into the, what, 70s, 80s?
I've gone beyond that. I stopped writing that posting in the 1990s.
Okay.
I've read quite a bit beyond that, but to delay it all out, just to even describe, because it's such a huge movement.
Right.
You know, if I wanted to give you a 1,500-word profile of what the World Bank is doing or what the UNFPA is doing, I mean, it would be hard to do that. This is a massive movement that, collectively, if you want to include a lot of the pharmaceutical programs there, their contraceptive divisions, it's got a budget in the tens and tens of billions of dollars. And if you go through the boards of directors of these organizations, you find these guys like the chief executive of that, what is it called, Burslin Marsteller, that huge public relations firm. He's involved. A lot of these people are very deeply plugged into the mass media. This is a very powerful movement at many different levels.
Yeah, because in your video, you spoke of video, what do you call it, sitcoms, and how it wormed its way into society starting in the 60s and 70s. We've got to take one last really quick break, and then we'll come back with you to the top of the hour. And I think there's going to be more, because I really want to find out how this fits into the whole, we have 21 genders thing. That
yeah.
We've got even more up here.
Oh, you have more? Oh,
geez. Oh, yeah.
No wonder you guys can't.
I read that article.
No wonder you guys can't learn your national anthem. You've got other things to worry about. We'll be right back with our guest, William Kay. You're listening to We the People. Join us online. WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Didn't have to keep it. Wouldn't put you through it. You could have swept it from your life, but you wouldn't do it. No, you wouldn't do it. And you haven't our baby.
Wow. Swept it from your life.
I know that.
Yikes.
Just like, kind of gave me the heebie-jeebies.
Another Canadian artist, I'll have you know.
Oh.
Paul Anka.
There.
You Canadians.
See, hey, we were talking on the break about...
lots of stuff, but...
Yeah, lots
okay,
of stuff.
I just was flashing through your table of contents, and one thing I want to make sure we don't miss is the population control movement banning DDT.
Yeah, DDT.
Because that whole Rachel Carson and Silent Spring was really an explosion of the environmental movement, and DDT didn't actually hurt people, but people still believe it's poisonous.
Yep, I would estimate that decision has killed several hundred million people.
Sure.
Because it killed mosquitoes.
Most of the mosquitoes.
Right.
Several hundred million. Yep, the 80% of all the infectious diseases inflicting humanity are carried by insects or small arthropods. DDT was represented a major breakthrough in insecticides. I list probably, yeah, I could have done more. There's actually been quite a bit written about this. Actually, online, there's even a malaria clock counting the number of people they think they've been killed by the DDT ban. DDT was absolutely harmless. You know, in World War II, American soldiers used to, you know, give themselves total body washes with DDT. No one got sick. It was a delousing agent. A lot of they helped out a lot of the refugees and displaced persons. One of the books I read shows that American soldiers were spraying these women's hairs with big clouds of DDT. They were lining up to get the treatment because it was killing the lice. It was absolutely harmless to people. In the, you know, 1950s, late 1940s, they became aware that the population control movement became aware of what an effect it was going to have. These people had already been campaigning against mosquito eradication. They're all over the United States. They're draining swamps and things near the cities, just kill the mosquito breeding grounds. One of the leading campaigners against DDT was someone who had for decades been campaigning against mosquito eradication. Like, they're pro-mosquito. You can even go online and find this Mosquitoes Unlimited
Save
document,
mosquito.
You know, because birds eat mosquitoes and, you know, they're part of the ecosystem. Well, mosquitoes are just a scourge on humanity.
Sure.
The Conservation Foundation, which the Osborne family set up in the 40s, financed a lot of this bogus research alleging that the DDT was harmful to humans, that it was wiping out various wild species. That served as the sort of groundwork for Rachel Carson's book. It was one of the most hyped, the most publicized books up to that date. Millions of copies were sold. And a lot of people hold that out as sort of the beginning of the modern environmental movement.
Yeah.
But I list in the website, you know, numerous quotes from leading environmentalists who quite explicitly say that this spraying of DDT is causing a human population explosion. And it was. Because malaria was such a scourge in so many parts of the world that the moment you took that out of the equation, so many more of their kids survived. You were seeing a very noticeable and very quick population growth in countries where the spraying had been going on. Usually it went on in conjunction with draining of swamps, draining of marshes near populated settlements. Something the exact opposite of what Malthus wanted. He wanted to put the settlements in the marshes so they would be living in these sort of bug-infested environments.
And now everything we have to do here is about wetlands. You know, everything is about a wetlands. We've got to have wetlands everywhere. I really like
the mosquito ranches, and also it's a huge waste of agricultural land.
Well, for people,
those are optimal places to have farms. Drain the wetlands, grow corn.
And you can't build, right? I just, for people who are not maybe big on going and reading all this stuff, I really hope you do. I hope you at least scan through the chapters and find things that are interesting, because in the population control movement, ban DDT chapter, if I can call it that. There's this one quote. In 1958, Aldous Huxley rallied the masses against DDT. Best known for his novel, Brave New World, Aldous was a staunch eugenicist and chronic Asiaphobe. He penned glowing reviews of one of Madison Grant's books, vigorous attacks on an anti-eugenicist play. Here was one of his quotes that you have here. Society must be organized on a caste basis. The rulers and their advisory experts will be a kind of Brahmins controlling, in virtue of special and mysterious knowledge, vast hordes of intellectual equivalent. I mean, of sutras
are untouchable.
And untouchables. I'm like, what the heck?
Yeah.
In the overall posting, you will find about a dozen quotes like that.
Aldous Huxley,
of these people,
I'm like,
population control, explicitly calling for some sort of totalitarian state.
Well, I can't believe we're out of time.
I can believe we're out of time. I had a feeling this was going to go like a little wildfire, but there's a lot in here, and I think that you know, it'll just get worse and or, you know, continue to repeat if people aren't aware of what they're looking at.
Yep.
And this is all packaged so well. We're really just babes in the woods looking at all this.
Okay.
Thanks a million.
My pleasure entirely. Thank you guys both.
We'll be chatting with you soon. We want to know how this brings us up to current time. Uh-oh. Oh, I guess he was all done.
He's done talking.
The indubitable William K.
He's gone.
He's off practicing the Canadian National Anthem. That's what we know he's doing.
Yeah.
All right, thanks for joining
Canada.
Us. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Tons of information today, including the memo that you keep hearing about, and I hope you go read it. It's real short, and it's very interesting.
And you can find us every Sunday on KCNR, Shasta Redding.